Very wise Jewish thinker who was slightly controversial, and I always abide by the rule of the Maharal, that the Maharal felt that sometimes it's worthwhile to quote an idea without quoting the source. Those who are interested in finding the source, you'll go find the source on your own. But the fact that it's true is no less true, regardless of who said it. The idea is the idea. There's a great Jewish thinker who said that religion throughout the ages has been used to comfort the troubled. You think of religion, you think of it as some sort of security blanket. I believe it was, there was a certain philosopher who called religion the opiate of the masses. I have a certain Rebbe who likes to argue that sports is actually the opiate of the masses. But that's maybe a discussion for another time. But he called religion the opiate of the masses, and maybe there's some truth to that. Religion throughout the ages has been used to comfort the troubled. However, this thinker thought that we should now use it to trouble the comfortable. That because of the wealth and general creature comforts that we find ourselves exposed to in the 20th and 21st century, so we forget sometimes the existential crises that kind of lurk beneath the surface of our lives, and we allow the fact that we each have, you know, many of the people, at least in this yeshiva, maybe not everybody, but many of the people in this yeshiva have second and third cars, and maybe they have vacation homes, and maybe they don't, but everybody here has clothing, Baruch Hashem, and has food, and, you know, poverty could be described as not having the latest Nintendo Wii or whatever, you know, came out, Baruch Hashem. And Jews should have plenty. I don't think anybody wants anything other than that. I think everyone should have plenty. But religion now comes to kind of wake us up. Like the call of the shofar, which the Ram describes as Uru Yesheinu Mishenaschem, to wake up the sleeping from their sleep in order to say, like, just because, you know, you're not going to sleep hungry doesn't mean that there aren't psychological and spiritual things that you're hungry for, that religion cannot help to wake you up to and to provide for you. When I think about Judaism, probably the first thing that I think about is how demanding it is of us in terms of almost the paradoxical nature of what it wants from us at any given moment. So that if I'm in a quiet moment of reflection by myself and I'm thinking about what is Avodas Hashem, what does that feel like, what is that experience of being a servant of Hashem? For me, in many ways, it's the experience of trying to juggle multiple feelings at the same time. I'll give you a very classic example from the Sifrei Chassidus. In source number one, Isamei Rav Bunim Mipshischa. The Rebbe Rav Bunim of Pshischa was famous for saying, Shelakol Yehudi Tzarech Lios Shnei Kisim. Every Jew is a world-famous idea that every Jew has to have two pockets. In one pocket, some people practice this literally, some people have this, the two pockets of their heart. In one pocket, a little petek, a little sticky note that says, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. The whole world was created for me. And at the same time, in the other pocket, just out of reach of the first pocket, Va'anochi Afar Ve'efer. I am dust and ashes. So that a Jew understands that at any given time, you have to pull out from one pocket, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, and Anochi Afar Ve'efer in the other pocket. And it's almost an impossible juggling act to say, the world was created for me, everything else that exists in the world is merely a figment of my imagination, I think therefore I am, and therefore only I exist, and my relationship with Hashem is the only thing that matters. If I don't do it, no one's going to do it for me. The world is created solely for me. My parents only exist for me. My friends only exist for me. My rabbeim only exist for me. Maybe they don't even in a philosophical sense, you know, certain philosophers, not obviously not Jewish philosophers, but certain philosophers thought that, you know, you can't prove anyone's existence except your own. Maybe all of this is just a dream. I don't really exist. Only you exist, the one who's thinking about this. Bishvili nivrolim. Everything else is just, life is but a dream. The only thing that truly exists is my consciousness. And at the same time, Anochi Afar Ve'efer, and I live completely for other people. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, in the beginning of Nefesh HaChaim, his son writes in the Hakdama that every single day he would hear in his father's house at some point during the day, He can't remember a single day going by that his father didn't say that we don't exist for ourselves, we only exist for other people. And finding a healthy balance between those two worlds of complete narcissism, where the only thing that exists is me, and complete distraction from self, and saying that everything outside of me exists, but I don't have to take care of myself, is a juggling act of massive proportions that makes our job in this world so difficult and so exciting. At the same time, that statement of Rav Simcha Bunim was stated really earlier in Tanakh by David HaMelech himself, my namesake. David HaMelech said that in Perek Ches of Tehillim, in the 8th Perek of Tehillim, David HaMelech said, Ma enosh ki tizkirenu ven adam ki tifkidenu. What is man, that God you should remember man? What is man? Why do we have any place in this world? Anochi afar ve'efer. And then the very next pasuk, v'tichasreinu ma'at me'elokim v'kavod hadar ta'atrehu. That you made him just slightly underneath the angelic beings of the world. We're only second to the top creatures in the spiritual realm. Well, what are we? Are we dust and ashes? Are we nothing? Or are we not deserving of even Hashem's remembrance? Or are we the most exalted beings in this world? That struggle between being Afar and Efer and Bishvili Nivra Olam is just one of many juggling acts that Hashem would have us have as servants of God. Of course, David HaMelech, which in many ways Sefer Tehillim is the repository of wisdom for all human emotion from the perspective of the divine. David HaMelech writing, of course, in Sefer Tehillim, which is part of Ksuvim. Abarbanel writes that the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim is that Nevi'im, Hashem told the Navi something and said, I want you to write this down. Ksuvim was a human being who was inspired to write something down, and then afterwards, through divine prophecy, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you know what you wrote down? That was actually me writing it down through you. That Ksuvim, which one is higher, you know, you can argue amongst yourselves, that Ksuvim is, Hashem gives a stamp after the fact and says, much like a person who makes a piece of music or writes a beautiful poem, and then afterwards reflects on it and says, whoa, which has happened to me many a time. You write a piece of music and you look back and say, who wrote that? I didn't write that. I don't know where that came from. Ksuvim is that feeling, except with the actual stamp of HaKadosh Baruch Hu via the agency of a Navi, or oneself being a prophet, to understand that something that happened was actually divinely inspired. And David HaMelech, who speaks of all of the emotional rainbow of human existence, in Sefer Tehillim, there's no shortage of contradictory expectations of the human being. On the one hand, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha bo lefanav birnana. We have an obligation at all times to serve Hashem b'simcha, mitzvah gedolios b'simcha tamid. I think I saw some hippies jumping on the back of a van singing that earlier this week. And at the same time, less hippies jumping on the back of vans singing this Mizmor Tehillim. Ivdu es Hashem b'yira v'gilu b'rada. Serve Hashem with fear. And even the end of the pasuk itself is self-contradictory. Gilu b'rada. Rejoice in trembling. So that when a Jew looks inwardly or tries to pick out of one of his pockets, b'shvili nivra olam anochi afar ve'efer, serve Hashem b'simcha or with deep seriousness, with joking, or with like utmost seriousness, not allowing oneself to even for a moment, for a fleeting moment, allow his heart to open to some foolishness. Gilu barada, to serve with great simcha, with great joy, and at the same time trembling, simultaneously. The feeling of enjoying a summer when we're supposed to feel the sense of simcha, and at the same time it's the 3 weeks and HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects us to put away all the toys and all the barbecues and to focus on the fact that the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and then at the same time telling us, but don't say tachan because it's really a moed, because Mashiach was born on this day, because this is the beginning of the redemption. Don't wear tefillin, but then put it on by mincha. And all the time feeling like we're not exactly sure how we're supposed to feel, all the ups and downs of Judaism, even within a single day. And as those who are called the Dorshei Rishimos, those who darshan interesting nuances of the Hebrew language, we'll notice that even the terms Yira and Ahava, which means fear and love of God, the two pillars upon which our entire Avodas Hashem rests, Yira and Ahava, as is pointed out by those who darshan things in this way, are two emotions which are expected of us at all times, but that simultaneously they are not mutually exclusive, but they go together in the most harmonious of ways, even though they seem to be polar opposites. So that if you take the word Yira and you take the word Ahava, as you have on your paper in front of you, and you look both sideways and up and down, they interlock. So that the word Yira spelled across, Yud Resh, Aleph Hey, and the word Ahava, Aleph Hey, Bez Hey, works both simultaneously across as well as up to down, Yud Resh, Aleph Hey. Because the two link together in this almost ironic harmony that Hashem is expecting us at the same time to be the height of creation and to be Afar Ve'efer. B'shvili nivra olam v'anuchi Afar Ve'efer. Ma enosh ki tizkurenu v'tachzrenu ma'at min ha'alokim. Hashem made us just slightly below God Himself. That on the one hand, ivdus Hashem b'simcha, at the other hand, gilu b'rada, to tremble in our fear of God. This struggle in our Avodas Hashem is borne out not only, of course, in these various dimensions of service of God, but in our every step. And perhaps it was with that in mind that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai argued for 2 years and a half about whether or not it would be preferable for man to be created. The language of that Gemara, which some of you have heard already this year several times in various contexts, is the Gemara in Erevin on Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, Tanu Rabbanan Shtei Shanim Umechtza Nechleku Beis Shammai Beis Hillel Halu Omrim Noach Lo La'adam Shelo Nivra Yoser Mishenivra V'Halu Omrim Noach Lo La'adam Shenivra Yoser Mishelo Nivra. And people often mistranslate this Gemara as saying, is it better for man to have been created, or is it better for man not to have been created? Certainly we believe in the fact that Hashem is Tov, and it is the nature of Tov to be Meitiv Lezulas, it is the nature of good to do good to others. Certainly Hashem did not create us as a science experiment gone wrong. But rather the question is it Noach lo la'adam? Would it have been, what does Noach mean? Would it have been easier? Would it have been more simple? Would it have been more restful for us not to have been created? So that in reality, what the Gemara comes to the conclusion is that it would have been more simple for us not to have been created. But now that we're created and we're sent into this massive struggle, the struggle of Ahava and Yira, the struggle of Anochi Afar Ve'efer B'Shvili Nivra Olam, all of the struggles of the two pockets of the Jew and of the human being make it so that this world is not Noach Lanu. It is not simple for us. It is a struggle. It is a difficult struggle. To the point that Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin writes in source number 6, and I won't read the whole thing inside, but it's a beautiful, beautiful piece from his Sefer Resisei Laila. In the very end of the piece in Resisei Laila, Rav Tzadok writes that for this reason, if one were to look throughout Shas, you find that whenever somebody leaves the world, when a tzaddik finally leaves the world, it doesn't say that he died, but rather it says, Noach Nafshe, his soul rested. Because life is nothing less and nothing more than the sum total of a deep and painful struggle, a juggling act, which is not just some spectacle for a circus, but an existential crisis of love and fear on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. So that when a person finally leaves the world, noach nafshe, we could say about that person, it's finally time for him to, quote-unquote, rest in peace. Because the struggle, the torrent of emotions which a person is expected to balance has finally subsided. Noach nafshe. He can finally rest his soul. Oh. So, just to see one or two more ideas before we jump into Rav Soloveitchik, now that we've painted kind of a broad picture of this human experience, the human experience of struggle. So before we jump into Rav Soloveitchik, just one or two more ideas where we see this in other thinkers, so that we will hopefully fully appreciate the way that Rav Soloveitchik puts it in the way that only Rav Soloveitchik could put it. Let's take a look at the Pia Zetzner Rebbe in source number 7. The Pia Zetzner Rebbe, of course, was the Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto. He probably unwittingly was the greatest theologian to come out of the Holocaust in terms of grappling with issues of human suffering and the statement of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Imo Anochi Betzara, that Hashem says, I am with Jewish people, I am with human beings when they suffer. But in a unique way, of course, by the Jewish people, the Bechor Yisrael, Jewish people being the unique children of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the Piazetz Rebbe writes in Chovas HaTalmidim, his book to beginning students, who are kind of a rite of passage into the world of service of Hashem, says the Piazetz Rebbe in source number 7, Aval al tidama shmeitza shme'ata tuchol kvar latakin es kol chaser nosecha v'tta'ale af belo avoda. Do not delude oneself. One should not delude oneself to imagine for oneself that he'll be able to fix all of his shortcomings without struggle, without hard work. Lo tita taos maguna, do not make this disgusting and base mistake. Ki belo avoda efshar rak l'rakev bekever, the only thing that a person can do without work is disintegrate in the kever. Velo yoser, that is the only thing that a person can do without having to work. Aval histakin li yos Yisrael ever Hashem, in order to make oneself into a true servant of God, yicholim rak ba'avoda, this can only happen with severe and passionate struggle. V'lo avoda pa'amis u'ba'akrai, not occasional struggle here and there, pam oved u'pam azov, one time to work hard and another time to kind of let the day go by, ela ba'avoda tmidis, with constant struggle, v'chol yamei chayecha, for an entire lifetime, yamei chayecha hayamim kol yamei chayecha halelos, kol yamei chayecha, meaning including the nighttime, making a play on the Gemara in Brachos, that not only do we have to say Kriya Shema at night, but during the day, but even at night, he says, kol yamei chayecha, all the days of your life, you have to struggle. Not only this world, but the world also to come. Not only in the day, but also at night. Asr lecha la'asiach daitcha mimcha u'miavodasecha. Not to, for a moment, pull oneself away from this struggle of the balancing act of b'shvili nivra olam and anochi afar ve'efer, ava and yira, simcha and gil barada. Yeah. Yeah, yes. Yes, the Haggadah is also paraphrasing. Yes, exactly. Exactly. The Haggadah is paraphrasing the fifth Mishnah in Masechet Brachos. Right? Yeah. And finally, again, for the interest of time, I'll come back to it if we have more time at the end, but of course, this is reminiscent of Rav Soloveitchik's great Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe of Lubavitch. Rav Soloveitchik, as is well known, as we'll spend a class trying to decipher, Rav Soloveitchik, when he was a young child, spent a decent amount of time in a cheder that was run by a Chabadnik. And this Chabadnik was very, very fond of the Alter Rebbe of Lubavitch, and specifically the text Tanya. It's a well-known story that Rav Soloveitchik one time, I won't give away too much now because we'll have a whole class on this, Mirtz Hashem, probably not till after Sukkot. But Rav Soloveitchik one time attempted to teach his students Tanya one summer, and after a while they said, could Rebbe just go back to giving Gemara shir? To which Rav Soloveitchik famously quipped. He said, all they want is Soloveitchik's mind. Nobody wants Soloveitchik's heart. So the Rav certainly was one who felt connected. It's not uncommon. I would say the Hasidic text most quoted by Rav Soloveitchik, the Sefer Hasidus that is most often cited by Rav Soloveitchik, is certainly Tanya, although I have collected quite a few sources from him quoting others, including the very famous Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. There are quite a few places where he quotes Rabbi Nachman as well. I'm in the middle of writing a book called Chassidus Harav, because people don't understand how much Rav Soloveitchik was influenced by Chassidus. But, okay, that's for another time. Anyway, the Tanya is very, very heavily based on this notion from Rav Chaim Vital, really stemming from the Arizal and even earlier sources, that a person is comprised of two parts of the soul. One is called the Nefesh HaBahamis, the animal soul. And of course, on the other side, you have the Nefesh Elokis, the Neshama Elokis. You have the animal soul and the godly soul, which are struggling for even playing time. And the whole goal of life for the Beinoni, for the average Jew, is to somehow find a way for the Neshama Elokis to overpower the Nefesh HaBahamis, so that not you could reject the physical, but you can use the physical, you can subjugate the physical to the will of God. Again, we'll read that inside. If we have more time, we'll come back at the end, but I couldn't not point that out. What we've basically seen is that when a Jew comes to serve Hashem, he had better come prepared to meet at that crossroads of the struggle between various tensions. So that when we're about to begin davening, and we open up the siddur, the very last thing that we say before we begin Pesukei Dezimra is we recite one of the 13 ways of darshaning Torah, which is, in source number 9, V'chein shnei ksuvim hamachishim zeh atzeh ad sheyevo akasov ashlishi v'achriya b'neihem. That all of life, and specifically all of tefillah, which is that world of avodah shebelev, of working on divine service, of trying to create a sincere and deep relationship with Hashem, which really is the paradigm for all of our service of God, whether it's frontal mitzvah observance, whether it's intellectual observance through the study of Torah, whether it is mundane activities with an eye towards our benevolent Creator, whatever it is that we're doing, it's always an experience of v'chein shnei chesuvim hamachishim zeh atzeh ad sheyevo akasov ashlishi v'achriya b'neihem. Two struggling texts which are desperately looking for a third to resolve it. So that all of life could be described as this tension between two texts that are being resolved through a third. And in some girsos, in fact, the Alter Rebbe himself, the Baal Tanya, the first Lubavitch Rebbe, had the girsa, which is in parentheses, v'kan shnei ksuvim. And here, as one is about to engage in the art of tefillah, we are met with two paradoxical psukim which are arguing and debating for our attention. And it is only through the act of divine service that we can somehow resolve this tension. And Rav Soloveitchik is going to show us that all of religious life is about awakening that tension and somehow creating the exaltation of this tension, raising this tension to a level of divine service, and thereby resolving it in our lives, resolving the tension through this religious experience. So that when a person comes to tefillah, which is that ultimate religious experience, it's not just a cute idea, but think how deep it is that when a person comes to tefillah, he's resolving the following three psukim. I never saw this inside any particular sefer, but it seems to me, it smacks to me as being true. Sources 10, 11, and 12. On the one hand, we have a pasuk that says, "Ata hareisa ladas ki Hashem elokim, ein od milvado." We are bearers of a truth that ein od milvado, which of course, if you've been even to one class by Rav Aaron, so then you know that ein od milvado doesn't just mean, or if you've read Shar Yichud Be'emunah of the Baal Tanya, you know that ein od milvado does not mean that there is no other God but Hashem. It doesn't mean that we are denouncing the pantheon, that you know there is only Hashem, there is no Zeus or whatever the snake lady's name is, or all of those, Medusa, or any of those other gods. Those gods don't exist. Only our God exists. That's not what we mean when we say Eino Milvado, but of course, Eino Milvado means there is nothing in this world except for Hashem. This table, this speaker, nothing else except for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, that's kind of difficult because we have another text in the very same book that was written by the same author that says, Vayomer Elokim Nase Adam B'Tzelemeinu. So we are created. We feel not only existentially, but we have biblical proof of our existence. Nase Adam B'Tzelemeinu K'dmuseinu. And the resolution of that tension, which is basically everything we've been talking about over the past 25 to 30 minutes, the resolution of that tension between only God exists and only I exist, which on some level, there are times in our life where it's not so hard to feel only I exist, but the difficulty is, does God exist? And then there are some times when we feel only God exists, do I really exist? And in that moment, we come to the tension, the paradox, and the beauty of religion. Where a person comes to that third pasuk, v'kan shnei ksuvim ha'achishim zeh, two pasukim which seem to struggle for our attention, until we have that third pasuk which resolves the two. And that is, u'la'avdo b'chol levavchem v'chol nafshechem. That Hashem says, come and serve me with all of your heart and all of your soul. Afilu hu notel es nafshech, even if Hashem takes your soul, because ultimately, Eino Milvado is true, but at the same time, we exist. And therefore, in that paradox, we find ourselves in the spotlight of Avodas Hashem. So now let's turn to Rav Soloveitchik, because ultimately, even though we just spent the majority of the time the majority of the time, kind of bringing ourselves to understand where we're coming from. So Rav Soloveitchik jumps in with, or we will jump into Rav Soloveitchik with two of his most famous and ultimately most defining essays of his thought. Of course, those are Halachic Man and The Lonely Man of Faith. In terms of Halachic Man, we're going to deal mostly now, and I'm going to read somewhat quickly, and there will certainly be time for questions, but I'm going to read somewhat quickly. Some of Rav Soloveitchik's language is difficult, but that's why it's easier if, you know, especially if you're hearing this for the first time, for someone else to read it for you. Rav Soloveitchik in Halachic Man, really at the outset of Halachic Man, deals with this issue of the struggle and how ultimately it is a redemptive experience and it is a exalted experience. And then Lonely Man of Faith, which it takes about 8 chapters for Rav Soloveitchik to get to the point of that this struggle is the purpose of existence. And the first 8 chapters are defining who these two struggling entities are, or what these two struggling entities are. So for Halachic Man, we'll skip a little bit in the middle, just because we don't have time to go into the philosophy of who some of these people are. If you're interested, by the way, in studying Halachic Man with a very, very interesting, I don't want to call him an expert in Halachic Man, because I don't know him personally, but very well-versed and very interesting human being. So there are free shirim online in Halachic Man that are still an ongoing series that are being given by a Jew named Reb Shmuel Braun. Shmuel Braun is a fascinating individual. If you want to hear more about him, I'll tell you more about him after. Kind of a young guy, very, very steeped in the world of Western philosophy, very, very bright, and kind of unpacks Halachic Man with a mixture of Western philosophy and Chabad Chassidus. It's really interesting, and I'll tell you more about that if you're interested after. But listen well to Rav Soloveitchik's words. Halachic Man reflects two opposing selves. Two disparate images are embodied within his soul and spirit. On the one hand, he is as far removed from homo religiosus as East is from West, and is identical in many respects to prosaic cognitive man. Homo religiosus for Soloveitchik means the classic spiritual model of, let's say, a Hasidic Rebbe. The ascetic pietist, the person who is the caricature of a spiritual man. As opposed to cognitive, prosaic man is more of the scientific thinker, the one who wants to explore and understand, who doesn't want to be wrapped up in the mystery of creation, who does not exalt in the mystery of creation, but wants to understand everything deeply. Halachic man, again, reflects two opposing selves. He is, on the one hand, as far removed from homo religiosus as East is from West, and is identical in many respects to prosaic cognitive man. Meaning, he possesses both qualities of this deep spiritual mystic, and at the same time wants to understand and aims at uncovering the mystery, not in terms of keeping it a mystery, but wants to understand the workings, the inner workings of how the whole world works. To give a very, very base mushel, the person who loves driving cars versus the person who and revels in the experience of driving safely, of course, down a highway at the maximum speed limit allotted by the country, and enjoys that kind of rush of freedom of being able to drive and the mystery of kind of like where am I going and a destination and a journey and all those feelings, versus the mechanic who wants to understand exactly what is moving this car. And somehow, again, that's a very, very rough analogy, but somehow Halachic Man finds himself in the balance between these two, homo religiosus and cognitive man. On the other hand, he is a man of God, possessor of an ontological approach that is devoted to God and a worldview saturated with the radiance of divine presence. So on the one hand, he's a science man, on the other hand, he's a God man. For this reason, it is difficult to analyze halachic man's religious consciousness by applying the terms and traits that descriptive psychology and modern philosophy of religion have used to characterize the religious personality. Why? Because, as Rav Soloveitchik goes on to explain, which we're going to skip now, because halachic man doesn't fit into the category of the regular religious man. A religious man is a mystic who is devoid of this cognitive, scientific, exploratory, intellectual aspect of humanity, and is very much focused only on the what is beyond, and trying to understand meaning versus how things work. So halachic man doesn't fit neatly into this category of religious man, and doesn't certainly fit into the category of scientific man, because he's devoted to God and a worldview saturated with the radiance of divine presence. So how do we understand halachic man? So again, Rav Soloveitchik goes on to kind of grapple with this duality of halachic man. We'll skip now down to the last paragraph on the page. Halachic man is an antinomic type for a dual reason. Again, he's now saying the same thing in different words. Rav Soloveitchik says he is antinomic. He is hard to pinpoint and put into a box for two reasons. Number one, he bears within the deep recesses of his personality the soul of homo religiosus, the soul of which, as stated above, suffers from the pangs of self-contradiction and self-negation. On the one hand, it's hard to put halachic man in a box, because just religious man himself, the mystical man, of course, is trying to remove himself from this world, but at the same time lives in this world. He's got to eat. So he grapples with being a torn personality himself, this religious man. But then once you throw in number two, at the same time, a halachic man's personality also embraces, flip the page, the soul of cognitive man. So now you throw in this kind of third aspect, and his soul contradicts all of the desires and strivings of the religious soul. So now here's where Rav Soloveitchik, here's what I said before. Our goal here is not so much psychological. Our goal is not so much academic, but our goal is to become better servants of Hashem. And says Rav Soloveitchik that you might think that the goal of life is to run away from this struggle, to seek shelter and comfort in the religious experience. But Rav Soloveitchik said that the true halachic man, which is what Rav Soloveitchik would want us to all be, again, we're going to see a lot of thinkers, so what Rav Soloveitchik would want us to be, maybe someone else wouldn't want us to be, and kind of, I guess, part of the fun of life is, you know, part of the, I guess, joy of growing up from the background that we did is we get to read everything, and we get to kind of take a little bit from here and there, so that on one day of the week we need to dip into Rav Soloveitchik, another day we need to dip into Rabbi Nachman, another day we need to dip into the Satmar Rebbe, and another day we need to dip into Rav Huttner. And all of those beautiful worlds can come together and enrich our lives, and we're not necessarily bound to one particular thinker. I think that's one of the worst and best things about our particular upbringings, that we don't have a clear path, but at the same time that leaves us open to kind of become cholent Jews. Take a little, you know, take a little barley, a little potatoes, a little beans, a little... You don't like beans? Okay, so you leave the beans out, and you put in this, right? A little barbecue sauce, and then you're not more into ketchup. You can take whatever you want. There's no mahalach, as opposed to, like, if you have, like, you know, this is how my mother always made it. You only have one recipe, so then you're stuck. There's nothing you can do. For us, Baruch Hashem, we have the ability to kind of pull from everything, and that, I think, Rav Soloveitchik would like, because it helps us to struggle. So listen to this now, because this is really the point which is going to inspire us to be better servants of Hashem. Because we shouldn't run away from the struggle. As I was speaking to one of my guys here in Yeshiva, and I said to them, what's your goal this year? And they said to me, my goal is that by the end of the year, I want to be more comfortable in my Judaism. I want to feel more comfortable in my skin and my Judaism. And I said to him, I hope you fail at your mission, because I hope that by the end of the year, you will be uncomfortable in your Judaism. I hope that this year will make you feel that you're challenged, that you'll constantly be uncomfortable in your Judaism. They'll constantly be working to try to improve it and to make it different and to make it better and to make it richer and to make it more nuanced, and to, that you shouldn't, God forbid, peak out at 18, 19 years old and become comfortable in your Judaism, but rather that this year should set you on fire so that you'll constantly be uncomfortable in your Judaism. That's what I said to him. So I don't know if I'll come back for a second conversation, but we'll see what happens. Okay, so this is what Rav Soloveitchik said. However, these opposing forces which struggle together in the religious consciousness of halachic man are not of a destructive or disjunctive nature. It's not destroying you by being ripped apart and being pulled in all these different directions. Halachic man is not some illegitimate, unstable hybrid. On the contrary, out of the contradictions and antinomies, there emerges a radiant, holy personality whose soul has been purified in the furnace of struggle and opposition and redeemed in the fires and the torments of spiritual disharmony to a degree unmatched by the universal homoreligiosis. In other words, Rav Soloveitchik says, you think being homoreligiosis, being the mystic, the Hasidic Rebbe who is torn between this world and being bedveikus b'Hakadosh Baruch Hu, who's being torn between should I or shouldn't I eat that extra piece of kugel, that's homoreligiosis. You think that's struggle? Throw in cognitive man and make yourself halachic man, and then your struggle is all the more so, and then the payoff is even more. Because in the furnace of that struggle comes out a person who in the fire and torments of spiritual disharmony is purified to a degree unmatched by the universal homoreligiosis. He's something different. He's a halachic man. The deep split of the soul prior to its being united may at times raise a man to the rank of perfection, which for sheer brilliance and beauty is unequaled by any level attained by the simple whole personality who has never been tried by the pangs and spiritual discord. Now, whether or not the person who happens to be giving the shir thinks that the ideal human being is the halachic man or not, whether you think being the halachic man is the ideal or not, you cannot help but be moved by Rav Soloveitchik's portrayal of what it means to struggle for something. And cannot help but be moved by his beautiful language. It's like a poem that Rav Soloveitchik is writing here. And so, I will read for you now one of the most beautiful works of prose that I have ever read in my short life as a person who is interested in reading prose. Turn to where you have the notes, the footnotes of Rav Soloveitchik. This is the famous footnote, footnote 4. Probably the most often cited footnote of Rav Soloveitchik in all of his writings. And we're not going to read the whole thing, but I beg you to read it because it's so beautiful. And I'm going to ad-lib for a moment. You really want footnote 4, kind of starting from the second page, which begins Protestant groups on the top of the page. But I'm actually going to ad-lib, and I'm going to take out the word Protestant groups or American Reform and Conservative Judaism. And we're just going to take that away because we don't really understand the context in which Rav Soloveitchik is writing. We're not living in that time. So this actually sounds a lot more like us than them. So I don't know what Protestant groups or American Reform and Conservative Judaism were to Rav Soloveitchik at that time, but that doesn't matter. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out that particular, and I'm going to throw in a more general term, and I'll just call it shallow religion. Okay, that's what we'll call it. So we'll start the sentence like that. Shallow religion, comma, we need the beginning of the sentence. Shallow religion gives lie to the position that is prevalent nowadays. We'll skip that. That the religious experience is of a very simple nature that is devoid of the spiritual torturousness present in the secular cultural consciousness of psychic upheavals and of the pangs and torments that are inextricably connected with the development and refinement of man's spiritual personality. In other words, this is not here comes the beautiful, beautiful prose. Rav Soloveitchik says that shallow religion gives lie to this experience that come join our religion, it'll make your life so happy. You'll be so comfortable. You'll be so at ease with yourself. Like this Bacher said to me in my conversation with him, I hope that this year will help me to be comfortable in my Judaism. When the goal, of course, as we said in the very beginning, is that religion should no longer come to comfort those who are tormented, but to make discomfortable those who are comfortable with their lives, and to make ourselves uncomfortable with our ethical and religious expectations of ourselves. So rather than allow this lie to be propagated, Rav Soloveitchik says, let's talk about what religion is actually supposed to do. This popular ideology contends that the religious experience is tranquil and neatly ordered, tender and delicate. It is an enchanted stream for embittered souls and still waters for troubled spirits. It's that image that we try to give off, you know, like when you go to some seminar about how to do Kiruv, and they're like, okay, so invite them over to your house on Friday night and make sure kids are perfectly dressed and they'll say cute little Dvar Torah, and you'll see how beautiful Judaism could be. When everybody knows that 20 minutes before Shabbos there was mayhem going around the house, and you know, one person screaming like, you know, go turn on the hot plate, and the other person screaming like, you know, we didn't open the diapers yet, and like tear the toilet paper because, and everything is crazy, and people are yelling at each other. And yes, of course, when finally the dust settles and you come to the Shabbos table, so things are beautiful. But to pretend like that's the religious experience, and to give everybody this notion that come, be Jewish, so that your kids will also wear cute little, you know, suits and sit at the table and ask for Shabbos juice, you know? That's very beautiful, but that's not what it's about, because of our salvation. So here comes, ready? You could put a little star right now. Actually, it's a little bit further, but I'll read one more sentence, and we're going to skip a little, and we're going to come to that, what I want to show you. The person who comes in from the field weary, from the battlefield and campaigns of life, from the secular domain which is filled with doubts and fears, contradictions and refutations, clings to religion as does a baby to its mother and finds in her lap a shelter for his head, the nest of his forsaken prayers. Again, this is Oliver Soloveitchik's making fun of the caricature of religion. And there is comforted for his disappointments and tribulations. Skip. Two. Skip two. Turn over the page for a second. Oh, here we go. You can make a little, here's where you should make a little star. See the paragraph that begins religion? This is the most beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. This is on page 142 if you're following along at home with the classic version of Halachic Men. Religion is not at the outset a refuge of grace and mercy for the despondent and desperate, an enchanted stream for crushed spirits, but a raging, clamorous torrent of man's consciousness with all of its crises, pangs, and torments. Yes, it is true that during the third Sabbath meal at dusk, as the day of rest declines and man's soul yearns for its creator and is afraid to depart from that realm of holiness whose name is Sabbath into the dark and frightening secular workday week, we sing the psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside still waters." And we believe with our entire hearts in the words of the psalmist. However, this psalm, only describes the ultimate destination of home religiosus, not the path leading to the destination. For the path that eventually will lead to the green pastures and to the still waters is not the royal road, but a narrow, twisting footway that threads its course along a steep mountain slope, as the terrible abyss yawns at the traveler's feet. Many see the Lord passing by, and a great and strong wind rending mountains and shattering rocks. And after the wind, an earthquake, and after the earthquake, a fire. But only a few prove worthy of hearing the still small voice. Out of the straits have I called, O Lord. Out of the depths have I called unto thee, O Lord. Out of the straits of inner opposition and incongruities, spiritual doubts and uncertainties, out of the depths of a psyche rent with antinomies and contradictions, out of the bottomless pit of the soul that struggles with its own torments, I have called unto thee, O Lord. Rav Soloveitchik says that, yes, it's true that the ultimate destination, noach nafshe, the ultimate destination is a person can leave this world, noach nafshe, he can leave at rest, knowing that he had a lifetime of struggle, and now he's ready to go to green pastures and still waters. When a person comes to Shal HaShudas, the third meal, that time which is called in the Svarim of the Tzadikim, Rava de Ravin, the will of wills, the desire of desires, that most exalted moment of the entire week, it comes only after an entire week of struggle, of torment, of crisis, of a battle between the Nefesh HaBahamis and the Neshama Elokis, what we refer to as Anochi Afer Ve'efer and Bishvili Nivra Olam, Ava and Yira, all of these doubts, all of these uncertainties, all of this juggling act, ends with Noach Nafshe. It ends with coming to that place of Shabbos, which is that world to come, that little piece of the world to come, but it only comes after struggle and torment and fighting and resolve to go on even though I'm bleeding and my knees are cut up. This, says Rav Soloveitchik, is the ultimate destiny of man. Okay, it looks like we're out of time here for this time, but I urge you to read as well the 8th chapter of Lonely Man of Faith, where Rav Soloveitchik, of course, has his portrait of Adam Aleph and Adam Bet, also known as Adam 1 and Adam 2, the majestic man and the humble man, and how the ultimate goal is for the resolution of those two, the struggle of those two coming together, which you could read about in Rav Soloveitchik's... I think you should hold on to it, because next time we're going to go on to a different topic. And there's some other interesting sources as well. We're going to do Rav Soloveitchik again next time, but we'll go on to a different topic in Rav Soloveitchik's slot. Okay, thanks guys so much.